Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dave Cullen. Cullen is a journalist and author of the bestseller Columbine. He is considered a leading authority on the Columbine High School massacre, and his book has been called a remarkable account of the April 20th, 1999 shootings. Columbine has been named a best education book of 2009 by the American School Board Journal and was named to many best of 2009 lists, including the New York and the LA Times. Cullen has also been a contributor to the New York Times, the Washington Post, Slate, and the Times of London. Columbine was published by 12 Books Press, and I'm speaking to Dave Cullen by phone from his home in Denver, Colorado. Dave Cullen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tish. Thanks for having me.
Let's set up the scene. It's April 20th, 1999. The Colorado High School massacre, known as Columbine, begins at about 11:20 in the morning. Let's talk about the guys that were involved in this. Let's start with Eric Harris.
Sure. Well, Eric was the mastermind. It was basically his plot. And he turned out to be a psychopath, in the clinical sense of that term. So not what most people need to forget what they think a psychopath is. And it doesn't mean a crazy person or anything like that. It means specifically a person who has no capacity for empathy, who completely disregards the feelings of other people. And only thinks about himself. They're egomaniacal, grandiose, but they're also very charming. So don't, you know, you got to let go of the idea of Hannibal Lecter, you know, in Silence of the Lambs saying, I'm going to eat your liver.
Mm-hmm.
He may be feeling that, but he's never going to tell you. Think of Hugh Grant. Think of somebody really charming. So they have this amazing capacity to fool us, but they're these unfeeling people, usually nonviolent. For a psychopath, typically, think of somebody like Bernie Madoff, you know, the Wall Street scandal, who was ripping people off from billions for years, but everyone trusted him, or the former governor of Illinois, Blagojevich, those sorts of people. But when you get a psychopath who's ruthless like that, who also has a sadistic streak, who enjoys hurting people, then you get somebody like, that's when you get like a Ted Bundy, a John Wayne Gacy, or an Eric Harris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very
Eric
rare.
Harris reminded me of Ted Bundy, the way you described him. And no one suspected this, right? He was an extrovert. He was a partier. He was popular.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
That's what shocked people.
He was. And he also, and he charmed people. The teachers, too. God, I've met some of the teachers at speaking engagements since then who stood up and said, you know, I knew Eric Harris, and I told people he was the nicest kid. He was such a fine young man. Look, they were arrested for a felony, breaking into a van, and they were put into a diversion program. So we had the notes where they had to do, you know, various forms of restitution and had to see a counselor every other week, and these meetings were all documented. And Harris' counselors really liked him. It was really clear. And they thought he was such a good kid who'd screwed up one time. They let him out of the program early. Only 5% of the people in the program are allowed out early. And Eric and Dylan were two of them, primarily because of Eric. And his exit interview and the write-up was just a few months before the killing, when he had it all set up, had most of the weapons already ready. The write-up is about what a fine young, outstanding man Eric Harris is, how he's going to do great things in life, and, you know, all about how wonderful he is.
So let's talk about Dylan Klebold. I mean, this was a toxic mix, obviously, these two guys. Dylan was just the opposite. He was depressed. He was insecure. Talk to us more about Dylan.
Exactly. You know, most people who ask me, I always get the same question first or very near the beginning, which is, why did they do it? And people are frustrated and confused, and you're always going to have difficulty with the answer if you think of them that way, as a they. And you nailed it exactly, that there's not this pair who's like, you know, joined at the hip. They're two completely different people who did it for different reasons. And Dylan was much more of a suicide. In fact, his was mostly a suicide, a classic angry suicide, who then takes people out with him and sort of shows people on the way out. So he gets together with Eric, and for more than a year they're talking about this. Dylan, over this time, most of this time, is writing in his journal that he's just really giving Eric lip service, and Dylan is planning to kill himself long before it ever happens and not go through with it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's enjoying the fantasy of this idea of, I could show a lot of people too, and I could take some people with us and show them how much they hurt me, how horrible life was for me. But it's all about the suicide. But over time, Eric really works on him and gets him the idea that, dude, quit blaming yourself. It's not your fault. You're not in the wrong here. It's not you. It's them. And gradually toward very, 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 very close to the end, Dylan seems to make the change over that, maybe I should take some people out. Maybe I should show them on the way out.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very different kind of motivation than Eric, who had no intention of killing himself, who wanted to hurt us and wanted to show how great he was. So they were coming from completely different places, but Eric understood Dylan's place, and Eric understood how to use Dylan and how to make it appealing to Dylan's and to meet his needs. Psychopaths are great for that. They're not going to try to give you their pitch of why they want to do it. They read you, figure you out, and figure out why you might want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
What's in it for you?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Eric played Dylan.
And the remarkable thing about this, too, is it wasn't just a school shooting. I mean, this was planned to be a massive, bomb-laden, maximum impact, statement.
Exactly.
So talk to us about this. I think a lot of people don't remember that they placed bombs in the cafeteria, in their cars. Now, the bombs didn't go off, but tell us about this plan.
Right, exactly. They wanted to be known as the worst terrorist attack in American history. And what they had set up was planned to be much bigger than Oklahoma City. So they had the two big bombs in the cafeteria, the two propane bombs, were the heart of the attack, and those were set to go off at 11:18. Which was a specific time because Eric was so cold-blooded that he'd gone into the cafeteria at various points and inventoried minute by minute how many people were in the room and how there was obviously a big rush of people at the start of a lunch, the first lunch, as you can remember high school, and kids swarming into the cafeteria. And then the numbers go down somewhat fairly quickly because lots of people are just rendezvousing and going out to their cars to, go out to Wendy's or wherever. So Eric logged it and determined that 11:18 was the maximum human density of anyone, anywhere in the school during the day where he could have his biggest body count. That's
mm-hmm.
all it's about.
Mm-hmm.
So they took two big propane bombs, wired up with nails and shrapnel and gasoline and all sorts of other things, and old-fashioned alarm clocks with those, the old kind with the bells on the top. So they wired those up, and they brought them in just in duffel bags, set them up, set them by two big poles, which would hopefully collapse and bring the second floor down as well. And this is all planned then. They walked out very briskly out the doors, out into the parking lot at a 90-degree angle to where their cars were at specific locations to take up their firing positions for the second phase. So those bombs were supposed to go off. They would have killed everyone in the cafeteria instantly, more than 500 people. The school would be blown up, would be crumbling to the ground and burning to the ground. And as it was on fire, then Eric and Dylan, during the intervening 2 or 3 minutes, would have geared up at their cars with all their weaponry. They'd actually practice their gear-ups, as they called it, so they could get the time really quickly. They would be standing there and ready. So as the school was burning down and the survivors came rushing out, then Eric and Dylan would mow them down with submachine guns.
But it didn't work this way.
It didn't. No. Instead, they were really bad at wiring. And psychopaths typically have an extremely high opinion of themselves, and they tend to screw up things like that. They think they've got it down. That's a bit of an aside, but they usually end up getting caught because they don't specialize. Most career criminals specialize. Psychopaths don't. They get bored. They think they've got it down. So Eric built his bombs, thought they were fine, didn't test them, set them up. None of the bombs worked, weren't even close to working, the timing devices.
Mm-hmm.
So the bombs didn't go off, and they had no plan B, which is also psychopaths never do. They think they're going to succeed. So they had no contingency plan. So the two met in the parking lot. Eric went over to where Dylan was, got him, and then went to the outside doors or the highest point on campus and apparently winged it and started opening fire. One of them, probably Eric, yelled, "Go, go," and then they started firing. Eric fired on literally everything that moved outside.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful day. lots of kids had been, you know, coming out to just, you know, eat lunch out in the grass, sort of a little picnic. He just started firing in every direction, and people started running or taking cover. He didn't hit many because they were at a distance, and it's very hard to hit a moving target at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Dylan was really slow to get involved. He only fired his weapon 5 times outside. Inside later, he would pick up the pace once he was one-on-one with Eric. But he
and then they went into the library. They eventually go into the library and start shooting people, correct?
They do, and that's where most of the damage really took place.
Mm-hmm.
They went into the school, and it's sort of a natural progression. The first big room you come to on the second floor, because it's built on a hill, so you enter on the second floor, was the library, and there were more than 50 people in there. So Eric and Dylan went in, and in there they just started doing horrible things. They started taunting everyone they came up to for whatever reason. Fat kid, they taunted for being fat. Jock, they taunted for being a jock. And then just firing at will and taunting some people and leaving them alone. Just to show they could.
Mm-hmm.
With other people, they would. Several people, they put the lip of their or they put their weapon under the lip of the table and fired without even knowing who they were shooting at under there. And so they went around. Eric in particular really enjoyed. He spent several minutes just taunting a girl named Bree Pasquale, asking if she wanted to live with a gun to her temple. She said yes. He asked why. You know, he made her beg for her life,
mm-hmm.
on and on and on. And then finally, when he got done with her, he said okay, and he walked away and didn't kill her.
This is the most unbelievable story, isn't it? Now, I don't want us to run out of time. There's a lot more to talk about. Let's talk about some of the myths that were revealed.
Oh,
you know, the
sure.
press kept reporting that this was the trench coat mafia, outcast taking revenge against bullies. Talk to us about how those are myths.
Yeah, you know, the trench coat mafia was probably the very first thing we learned and one of the most insidious myths, I think, because it allowed us to think that these were monsters who were particular, some kind of weirdos who weren't like us. And that, you know, well, we don't have any trench coat mafia at our school, so we don't have to worry about that. When in fact, you know, they weren't part of any weird gang like that. And they were, in most ways, they were sort of ordinary kids. Dylan in particular was a very ordinary, bright kid. So it wasn't about that. They had been sort of maybe fringe members at best of the Trenchcoat Mafia a year earlier, which had ceased to exist about a year ago, which was just sort of this ad hoc group of about 10 kids who were sort of in it. It had nothing to do with it. It wasn't about revenge against jocks. That was probably the other single biggest myth, that we thought this was all about jocks. And because they were bullied and there was this feud between the jocks and the Trenchcoat Mafia, and so this was a huge act of revenge of settling the score. There were kernels of truth in all of these things, which is how the stories got going. The Trenchcoat Mafia had been having a feud with the jocks a year earlier, but then the kids from the Trenchcoat Mafia mostly graduated. It didn't exist anymore. That was sort of over, and it had nothing to do with this. The killers did make fun of jocks at one point in the library, but they made fun of just about everybody in the
mm-hmm.
library.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read their journals, it's clearly clear it had nothing to do with the jocks. They aren't complaining about bullying. This was an active crime, not a reactive crime. And that's how the FBI looks at these things, is people who do something in reaction to something done against them, like the classic, you know, crime of passion where,
mm-hmm.
you know, a man walks in on his wife, you know, having an affair, grabs a gun and kills them both. That's a reactive crime. It's a response to something happening in his life specifically. An active crime, which is much less common, is this kind of thing where Eric just wanted to kill people. He wanted to hurt people and show how great he was. He set up a plan to do it, and it had nothing to do with the other people. The people in that school who he shot, they were just props in a black theater to him.
Mm-hmm.
I had nothing to do with it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dave Cullen. He's a journalist and author of the best-selling book Columbine. Now, Dave, one of the most upsetting myths and heartbreaking myths in this whole story was the one that surrounded Cassie Bernal.
Yes.
Tell us about this one. This is just heartbreaking.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I sort of just found out a heartbreaking later chapter to that I'll get to. But the situation with Cassie Bernal was that she was believed to be this Christian martyr who had professed her faith in God. And the story, which came out very quickly, which I repeated in some of my reports, we all thought was true, was that one of the killers had walked up to this girl, Cassie Bernal, asked, "Do you believe in God?" She said yes. He shot her in the head and killed her. And she was a martyr to her faith. Well, it turns out what actually happened is that there were two girls, and that there was another girl in the library named Val Schnurr, where this actually did happen, where Dylan walked up to her, but he had already shot Val with a shotgun blast. She had 19 different rounds into her body. Mm. She was bleeding. She would have bled to death. And she finally decided to make a break for it and to get out of there. She couldn't walk. She started trying to crawl out. And Dylan saw her, came up to her and started taunting her, asked her if she believed in God. She, in quite an act of faith, said yes. Then he continued to question her about it and sort of taunting her about it. Then he got distracted. Eric called him over, and he just let her go. He didn't care. She lived to tell about it. She lived through it. Cassie, on the other hand, was sitting under a table, and she was one of the people who was killed completely indiscriminately, where Eric walked up, slapped his hand on the top of the table, said, "Peekaboo," put his gun under the lip of the table, and shot her in the head. She died instantly without ever speaking. Mm. And it was all a misunderstanding. And it was a misunderstanding. Nobody intended to get that wrong. You know, it wasn't an intentional plot or anything. It was sort of bad reporting on the media, me included, after the fact, of just taking the story and believing it without, you know, checking it out with the witnesses and saying, how do you know it was Cassie? How well did you know her? Could you recognize her voice? How close were you sitting? You know, it turned out to be completely wrong. But the really sad thing for me now is I spent a lot of time interviewing Val Schnurr again the last couple months, and I wrote an afterword to the paperback edition that just came out where it centered on three people, and one of them is Val. And Val has made a remarkable recovery. She struggled really badly for 5 years. Well, she had four reconstructive surgeries and years of painful physical therapy. And it sort of messed her life up in other ways, but she's doing really well now. She just finished grad school. She's got a great boyfriend, great job, and she forgave the killers.
Wow, that's amazing.
She told me about a year ago that I bear no ill will toward Eric or Dylan anymore. She's just cut that loose. She's free of them, and she's going on with her life. But she still is really angry with Misty Bernal and with the whole situation with Cassie, which I didn't realize how much damage it had done to her life, because she was cast as a liar. Everybody thought she had made her story up for a while and that she was trying to profit off it, that she had heard the story about this martyr and wanted to get in on the action. And it humiliated her. She felt like she was being cast as a liar while she was, you know, going through these painful operations and people didn't believe her. And 11 years later, that's the part that's still painful to her.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that's what's really, to me, that's what's sad about that myth, because there's another victim here.
Yeah. Now, Dave, can you tell us anything else about some of the people who survived?
Yeah, there are some wonderful stories. And, you know, to me, one of the great things about reporting is it was difficult at times, to say the least. I had a couple bouts actually with secondary PTSD. But what got me through is that there were really amazing people. And, you know, half of the book is dedicated to the people who lived through it. And there's some great survivor stories. Like, well, my favorites are Patrick Ireland, the boy in the window, and then Mr. D, the principal, Frank DeAngelo.
Yes, tell us a little bit.
Okay, so Patrick was a kid who a lot of people will remember was about 3 hours into what we thought was a hostage standoff. Somebody started moving in the upstairs in the library, and a helicopter, newscopter, caught this and said, "Something's happening in there. Somebody's in there." And a SWAT team in a Brinks truck that they had commandeered rushed up toward the building to get him. As they realized there's a person up there, he's stumbling toward the window. He's going to jump. The car got there just in time. Four SWAT officers jumped out, clambered onto the roof, caught him just as he was coming out the window, all bloodied, delirious. This was live on CNN. So And so he was forever known as the boy in the window, and a lot of people didn't know what had happened to him, but he had been shot in the head and in the foot. There was a bullet 6 inches into his brain. The left side of his body was paralyzed. He had spent those 3 hours going in and out of consciousness and crawling toward the window. It took him 3 hours to get about 12 to 15 feet.
That's remarkable that he lived through this. It really isn't a miracle, isn't it?
It is, and not only did he live through it, the doctors told his parents he would probably be a vegetable. He would never talk coherently again. He would never walk. They didn't bother to set his foot because they told his parents he's never going to need that foot. Patrick was determined to recover. He knew what was going on. He was speaking in gibberish, but in his mind, he knew what he was thinking. He was determined to still be valedictorian. He was a junior. He'd never gotten a B in high school. He graduated valedictorian. He graduated from college magna cum laude.
That's amazing.
He learned to walk again. He even learned he had been a champion water skier. He learned to water ski again. He still walks with a limp, but he's married now. He's very happy. He also put it behind him. He's just an incredible, positive, person who decided just a few weeks after also decided to forgive the killers and just decided anger, hatred, any of that, like, that's not doing me any good. I'm just putting it behind me. I am going to talk again. I am going to walk again. I don't care about anything else of what happened to me.
And
he's a 17-year-old kid,
mm-hmm.
and he decided that and made this remarkable recovery.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the rest of the town. How did they react? I know you wrote a lot about how the police did some kinds of cover-ups.
Right. Yeah, there was it was pretty ugly for a while. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Department bungled a couple things. They did certain things very well. They did an amazing investigation. They pulled together, FBI and all sorts of different local jurisdictions and put together an amazing investigative team. So they did great on that tack. But meanwhile, they found out that they had been warned by Eric about Eric, and they were scared. They panicked and thought if this stuff comes out, that they had been warned that they would be ruined, that they would be ridiculed. And so they made a decision to cover it up. There was a big meeting with the senior officials to decide to cover it up. And news of this meeting didn't come out for, more than 5 years they held the secret. And it finally came out during a grand jury investigation where the officer who had done the original investigation on his third questioning finally admitted that, okay, there was a meeting. We basically did a cover-up. And
how did the town react to this?
Terribly. Well, this was actually the culmination of a series of things of a Jefferson County Sheriff's Department refusing to release information for years. So very soon after Columbine, there became this sort of tug of war with the community really losing faith in the sheriff's office and believing them and trusting them.
Mm-hmm.
And we could tell for a long time, like, why are you holding on to this evidence? Why are you not releasing this? And knowing that something was awry. And that went on for years. And so when the cover-up finally came out, they had already had about zero credibility. That was the last straw. And, I think that really made the healing process much, much more difficult for the community, because they want to know, why did this happen? At least explain it to us so this never happens again. And the people that we were relying on, who have the evidence, are not being truthful with us. So how do we know what to believe?
Mm-hmm.
That made it really, really difficult for them.
Yeah, yeah.
It all came out in the end. But
yes, it did. Thanks to your book as well. To tell us, if anything, what we've learned from all of this.
Well, we've learned a whole lot of things. I think in some ways we've learned some of the wrong things. I think the biggest thing that we should take out of this, may be surprising, but teenage depression is the thing that we should be focusing on here. One of the two killers did it only because he was suicidally depressed, and he never would have gotten involved or gone along with it if he hadn't been depressed. And that's really the silent killer here. Chances are remote that anyone in your high school, in your kid's high school or your high school, is going to shoot up the school and kill a bunch of people. That's probably not going to happen. It will happen someplace in America, but probably not your school. But the chance of someone in your school right now, particularly a boy, who is so depressed that he is going to kill himself is extremely high.
Mm-hmm.
If you've
mm-hmm.
got a school with a couple thousand kids, you've probably got multiple kids who are going to end up killing themselves. And if not, they're going to be involved with drug and alcohol. They're going to ruin their lives in lots of different ways. It is easily, I've got some of this information on my website. Several reports came out how 80% of the cases are not diagnosed. It's very easy to identify teen depression and treat it. So, that's what we should be, I think that's the biggest thing that we should have taken out.
Yeah, that's a lesson.
And that we should be focusing on.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you researched this book. You're one of the first reporters on this. You've been obsessed with this for now 10 years. Tell us how it's changed you. Yeah, how has it changed you?
It's about 11 now and counting. Well, that's kind of interesting. I had a couple bouts of PTSD, and I think it's made me much more sensitive and hypersensitive to anything that involves kids. I actually can't watch anything, even if it's a movie about kids being sort of hurt or anything where kids are kind of being mistreated.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't really handle that anymore. But hopefully, in positive ways, it's made me sort of, I think I understand victims a lot more. First of all, I understand PTSD and what they go through. I guess the biggest advice that I've learned and I can give to people who, when somebody is having any kind of trauma in their life or really any kind of grief, is let them heal at their own pace and their own way. That everybody handles grief completely differently. You know, even if it's your mom dying of cancer, some people need to grieve for a couple days and get over it. Some people need to go back to work and act like as nothing has happened for 6 months, then break down. There's no normal here, and the families in Columbine got really, really frustrated with attempts by the media. These sort of well-intentioned attempts to sort of rush the healing process. There was a headline the second day after Columbine in the Denver Post, a giant banner headline, page one, "Healing Begins." And every counselor I've talked to ever has gasped at that. Like, no, it doesn't. You know, most people don't really start their healing for 6 months. We haven't even started that process. And, 6 months out, the media sort of wanted to move on. Like, oh, are these people still upset about it? It's just beginning. I'll throw out one more stat. They tracked the mental health usage of the free mental health they set up at Columbine High School. And it kept rising. It didn't go down for the first 6 months after Columbine. It kept rising. It hit its peak and stayed at a plateau from 6 months to 18 months out.
So the lesson from this is we've got to let people heal at their own pace. Dave Cullen, can you give your website, please?
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. It's DaveCullen.com. Just Dave, C-U-L-L-E-N. DaveCullen.com. I've got all sorts of information. You can see the killer's journals there, and there's information on PTSD and ways to help victims and all sorts of things there.
Okay, great. Well, Dave Cullen, thank you so much for joining us. Your book is absolutely amazing. I hope people will read it, and thank you so much for joining us. The book is called Columbine.
Thank you, Tish. It's been really nice being on your show.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.